Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, later in the programme, I'll be talking to Patrick Usher, who'll share an insight into the life of his late mother, Mary Redmond. She was founder of the Irish Hospice Foundation. And we'll also hear from author John Scally, who has a new book called Beautiful Thoughts for Beautiful Minds. This week, we heard the news that the government has approved the forensic excavation of the site of the former Bon Secours mother and baby home in Tuam, County Galway. Significant quantities of human remains were discovered at the site last year. The mother and baby home operated from 1925 to 1961. It's more than 5 years since local historian Catherine Corliss discovered official records showing that 798 infants and children had died at the site in Tuam. The Tuam Babies Family Group has welcomed the decision by the government to allow the excavation. This week too, the BBC reports that China appears to have confirmed that it's running a number of re-education camps for Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang in the name of combating extremism. A UN Human Rights Committee has heard there are credible reports that China is holding 1 million Uyghurs in counter-extremism centres. The Uyghurs are a Muslim ethnic minority, mostly based in China's Xinjiang province. They make up around 45% of the population there. According to the Associated Press, as the Vatican faces declining numbers of priests worldwide, it's preparing the groundwork for a formal debate on an issue of opening up the priesthood to married men in parts of the world where clergy are scarce. Pope Francis has convened a meeting of South American bishops next year focusing on the plight of the church in the Amazon, a vast territory served by too few priests. During that synod, the question of ordaining married men of proven virtue, so-called viri probati, is expected to figure on the agenda. And the singer Sinead O'Connor has announced on social media that she's converted to Islam. The ceremony was conducted in Ireland by Islamic theologian Sheikh Dr. Umar Al-Qadri. Last year, she changed her legal name to Magda Davitt and will now be known as Shahada Davitt. And so to our first guest, Dr. John Scally. John lectures at the School of Religion in Trinity College Dublin and is the author of over 40 books and has just published his latest, Beautiful Thoughts for Beautiful Minds. And John joins us this evening. John, they call it the magic ratio of 5 to 1, 5 positive thoughts to prepare us to deal with the 1 negative one. Are you taking on that challenge for us?
That's very much what I'm about. And I suppose, as a Christian, for instance, you know, I'd be very conscious of the fact that one of the things that Jesus said was that I come that you may have life and have it to the full. And I think one of the things that interests me is that Christianity is supposed to be in the business of the good news. But again, I wonder if you were to do a vox pop down the streets of Dublin or any town in Ireland, would the first thing people might say about Christianity would be good news? And I suppose one of my favourite stories, for instance, about Jesus is that one day he's walking down the street and he sees a group of people at a crossroads. This is not a true story, it's in the apocryphal gospels, but there are all these people gathered around a crossroads, and he goes up to investigate to see what they're all doing. It's a really, really hot day, and there's a dead dog in the middle of the crossroads. He's obviously been dead for a long time, and he smells horrible, he looks revolting. And everyone is trying to outdo each other in terms of how disgusting the dog is and smells. And eventually someone says to Jesus, "Well, what do you think?" And Jesus says, "Well, at least he had a fine set of teeth." And I kind of think there's something kind of wise in that, just from forgetting about faith even, but just from a well-being mental health perspective, to try and look for the positive, because we are overloaded, I think, at times with the negative. And I think that's something that we need to do, to try and look for the little shaft of light. You know, one of my favourite singers is Leonard Cohen, and I'm sure people will know his song Anthem. He talks about the crack that will let the light in. And I kind of think we might be in a slightly better place if we tried to look for that crack.
Now, you were writing in the Irish Times after the visit of Pope Francis to Ireland, and I'm curious about how you perceived this that whole year and that whole experience for Roman Catholics in the country. Did it cause more unhappiness, or did it bring any hope?
I think the slightly political way of answering that question, Michael, would be to say it depends on who you ask. I think that there are, for certain people who may be of a traditional faith or are very deeply committed to their Catholicism, would have found the last number of years quite tough because, if you like, the goalposts in a various society have changed dramatically with the marriage equality referendum and with the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. And for some people, it's a great joy. But for other people, it's maybe created a lot of unease. And I think having Francis there, or here rather, for people in that situation, it did give them a much needed lift. I think, though, for other people who experience the church in a negative way, including very committed people like Mary McAleese, for instance, who find the church a difficult place maybe because of their attitude to issues like the place of women, homosexuality, it didn't actually do that. For me, though, I think, I suppose my abiding image of it will be the visit of Pope Francis to Brother Kevin's establishment. And I do think that, for me, I certainly took hope from that part. Obviously, people were very engaged by the response to child abuse, and a lot of people would have been dissatisfied with that. But in that kind of little visit, to me, there was very much a strong pointer and indication of hope in that what Francis is saying very clearly is, you know, the litmus test of our Christianity is not what we say, not what we preach, not what we profess, but how we live our lives, and in particular, the way we reach out to those who are on the margins of society, you know, who are homeless, who are, if you like, the bruised, the battered, and the broken.
Do people feel in a need or a sense of a desire for leadership at this particular point?
I'm absolutely 100% in agreement with you in that perspective, Michael, to kind of offer a vision of a society that is more just, more inclusive, more caring, more compassionate, but also that these words are so easy to say, but they're going to require us to take difficult choices. And to do that, we need to, I think, two things. We need to comfort the disturbed, but also, maybe critically, disturb the comfortable.
Well, let's explore this a little bit further, because you have a vast knowledge, not only of the area of theology, but of also sport. Yeah. A lot of people develop their leadership skills on the sports fields, in team activities and team games. Yes. But that's also changed. It's become extremely competitive now.
I would very much agree with that. And, you know, people often talk about the win at all cost mentality. So you set up your teams not to lose rather than go out to win.
As against the joy of winning.
As against the joy of winning. And the whole Olympic idea of participation, you know, that it's good just to be there and to take part. I think the interesting thing about sport, though, is sport holds up the mirror to society. And whatever is happening in society is going to be reflected in sport. So we do see from time to time the great things about society. We see heroism, we see sacrifice, we do see great community spirit, but we also do then see very strong individualism. We also see a massive desire to win, and sometimes winning whatever at whatever cost.
Now, I'm talking this evening with John Scally on the occasion of the publishing of his book, Beautiful Thoughts for Beautiful Minds. The title is often a great place to start with an author. And did that come first or last?
It kind of came last, in a sense that the idea was there for a long time, to try and, as I said, maybe offer a kind of a miscellany of different collections of thoughts, inspirations, bits of humour that might give people a smile, but also give people maybe a little bit of food for thought. And I suppose I also have to be very honest. We're in the area of transparency and accountability, and say I was conscious of the fact that at this time of the year, people are thinking about maybe a gift that might be able to give to someone. So that also impinged on the process.
Nothing at all wrong with that as an idea. But I, having read through the book, I'm thinking of the image that comes to my mind is a bit of a first aid cabinet, and that you don't actually have to read it sequentially, that you can dip in and out.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to, what, raise the spirits?
Yeah, I would. Now, that that's that might sound very grandiose, but I don't want to set myself up as a man who's got the cure for all the ills of society by any manner of means, but maybe I just think there might be some little bit of inspiration or guidance, or just maybe something that might make you think, something that might cause you just to step back and say, never actually thought about it quite like that before.
Now, they say youth is wasted on the young, and yet at the same time, you've capitalised on some of the stories from your own childhood.
Very much so. I suppose we you know, we are all a product of our environment and our childhood. And I grew up on a farm in Roscommon, a small farm, and my father died when I was very young, and so my grandfather was one of the main influence of my life. And I suppose he had a very strong, I suppose, spiritual value system.
You describe him as a great listener in the book.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think maybe that's maybe another little, you know, issue maybe to kind of raise, or maybe give people pause to think. You know, I think it's no accident that in Ireland we have the Blarney Stone, and people go to you know, to kiss it, and it's going to give them the gift of the gab. But I suppose I wonder sometimes if we had something comparable for our ears, because sometimes, you know, it might be better for us all if maybe we took a step back and were prepared to listen to people, including people we might not expect to have any agreement with or any value in. But, you know, even people who are wrong 99 times out of 100 can be right that 100th time. And there is a value, I think, in just listening and trying to be open to the wisdom we find in others.
I read recently that, you know, in the three phases of adult development, you know, the first phase, we desperately want to belong. In the middle one, we develop our own identity. And the third one, well, we kind of kick back and we're able to hold contradictory thoughts. I am getting the sense, reading through this particular book, that you've almost arrived at that point. That there are contradictions in life, but, you know, you're not sweating them.
No. Somebody said, told me recently, the three stages of life, youth, middle age, and you're looking well. And I think I'm probably at the you're looking well stage now at this stage. And you know, life is very complex. I suppose one of the things about childhood and youth, and I suppose as an educationalist I see this a lot, you know, with young people, they're very certain a lot of the time, and they're very black and white. And I suppose one of the big things you learn as you get older is that life is more complicated. There is an awful lot of grey.
We should say, John, that the book is from Cara Press. It is called Beautiful Thoughts for Beautiful Minds. I see Tony Ward gave you a little bit of mention. Of course, you know Tony from working and writing about him, yes?
Indeed.
I see that the royalties also are going to Epilepsy Ireland.
Yeah, we were talking about memory earlier, and I suppose, remember when I was 19, one day walking down the streets of Ballinasloe and seeing a young man in great distress, and he kind of fell on the pavement. And at that time, I had never heard the word epilepsy, but I remember kind of seeing him and seeing his distress, and just my body going into total shock, because I just didn't know what to do or what was going on. Thankfully, a nurse came along and was dealt with the situation, resolved it very quickly. But it's something that kind of stood in the back of my memory. And I suppose the whole issue of disabilities that are hidden is something I do think that we need a bit more conversation about, because as a child I learned the phrase, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. There is a wisdom in that, but I also think that when it comes to hidden disabilities, the lack of even a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And I hope maybe in a tiny little way, maybe this book might help shine a little light in that area.
John Scally, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
My great pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much.
Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Well, next on The Leap of Faith, many of you will know the name Mary Redmond. You may not know her as Mary Redmond Usher. She was a distinguished employment lawyer, academic and social entrepreneur, and founder of two national charities in Ireland, the Irish Hospice Foundation and The Wheel. Joining us on The Leap of Faith this evening is her son, Patrick, who joins us to talk about following the pink ribbon path. Patrick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Interesting, because we will go in a little bit more detail to the book, but this is somewhat of a reprint, although that's probably not quite correct either.
Originally it was published as The Pink Ribbon Path in 2013, and that was a book that my mum compiled in order to cope with her cancer diagnosis. In my last conversation with her, I promised her that I would produce a new edition of the book because I felt she had walked the path so beautifully. Now, 3 years later, the book is being published as Following the Pink Ribbon Path, and I've written a new introduction about her life, and we also have many new contributors as part of the book who talk about what my mum meant to them and what her path means to them.
What I think might be lovely for people listening tonight is to capture a little of the essence of the book, and to that end, you actually have a piece of poetry from it that you'd like to read to begin.
Yes, I do. It's actually the last poem in the book, and it is called The Pink Ribbon Path, and I think it encapsulates the journey very well. The pink ribbon path is the path of the heart, where the cry of the heart is heard. I will stay on this path, walk straight in its curves. I will not be afraid. I will not be perturbed. The pink ribbon path is the path of the heart, where the ear of the heart hears you.
When you hear those words, and the words of your mother, they also capture how she approached the end of her life.
They do. And throughout her whole period of illness, she had this amazing way of taking suffering as a catalyst for something greater. And for me, the abiding memory I always have of her is her smile throughout the years of illness. She, in fact, I even read in her diary entry from early on her first day of chemotherapy, she wrote that she was being asked to pick up a heavy cross, and may I do so with a smile. And that for me was, she was someone who, you could tell that it was the smile of someone who was deeply alive, deeply grateful for being alive. And she was able to take suffering and turn it on its head and still choose what was there of life to be lived.
I think let's go back a little bit and find out a little bit more about the woman herself. Tell us her potted history.
It's funny, when I think about my mum, I think about something that she told me when I was a kid. When I asked her, what's the meaning of life, mum? One of those.
You did?
I did, yes. Wow. I was one of those children.
You were a philosophical child.
Yes. I was a philosophical child. Sadly, it's kept on. And she answered me that it was to live, to love, and to leave a legacy.
Wow. Okay.
And her legacy is something that, you know, as her son, I can say with great pride, you know, was very significant. She founded two national charities, one before I was born, which is still going strong today, called the Irish Hospice Foundation. Mm. And another one when I was about 9 or 10, called The Wheel. And both of those are still, you know, doing great work today.
But for you as a young man, yeah, very often you forget that your mother was a young woman. Tell me about her early years. Around her 30s, her father became ill and died.
That's right. Her father, Sean Raymond, who worked in the Revenue Commissioners, he died, and he received very good end-of-life care in Our Lady's Hospice. And that meant a huge amount to my mother and to her whole family. And as a way of coping with the pain of the loss, she wanted to turn that into fuel for something greater. Mm. And she was acutely aware that hospice care was actually quite limited in Ireland at that time. We only had 3 hospices, for example. There was no provision for end-of-life care at home. And she wanted to set up a foundation to raise money for hospices and also to campaign for best practice. So in setting up the Irish Hospice Foundation at that time in 1986, it wasn't another hospice. It was a charity that was about how do we do end-of-life care better. And so the first thing she did was to raise money for a new hospice, St. Francis Hospice in Raheny. She also set up Sunflower Days. People, listeners may know about them in June, where you can buy a sunflower to support local hospice. And that's something which is, you know, still going strong, and it's raised €35 million over the years for local hospice causes. And she was big on getting hospitals to have hospice-friendly practices so that we could have dignified end-of-life care
Somebody who's involved in things like that often will get the label of being formidable. Would you use that about Mary?
I think when she had a vision for something, she was formidable. At the same time, she had a wonderful capacity to drop everything. Mm. You know, when she was home, she was mum, and she was fun, and she was irreverent. And, you know, she had a great sense of humour that a lot of people mightn't necessarily believe were they to meet her in her when she was, you know, working on some greater cause. Mm. But she had a great sense of fun, and she could just drop those things at home.
I want to move forward a little bit now, because it seems just, you know, to the outside observer, the sheer unfairness of somebody who's been involved in helping people towards the end of life, towards the hospice movement, then they get a diagnosis themselves. Were you around when that happened?
Well, when it actually happened, I wasn't. I was away in England at university, and she and my father kept it from me for a few months until I came home for the summer. And then she told me, and I remember being deeply shocked. My mum was always my rock, and I suddenly felt that was very, you know, tenuous. But I remember going over and holding her hand and saying, you know, I'm going to stay with you, mum. I had lots of plans for that summer, and I just dropped them, and I said, I'm staying with you. Mm. And I know that for her, there was a really dark period, and I don't think I was actually there for that start of that period. But at a certain point, I know she said, I'm making the decision to live. And that became the essence of the pink ribbon path that she developed.
Yeah. And the pink ribbon, of course, is making reference to the pink ribbon that people wear to show their support for breast cancer as well. Yes. We go to page 66. If you could just give us a flavour of this, my everyday.
Certainly. One of the things my mum said was that we can be ill yet whole. And this poem really encapsulates that idea that we can bring love to the symptoms that we feel and that we can care for them. So this, my everyday, reads, help me to accept my everyday just as it is, the quirky pains and aches all over, tenderness in hands and feet. This, my everyday, I lay before you as it is. Help me to love my everyday, every moment, where I can be all there with you and all here, giving myself unreservedly to this oneness. This, my everyday, I lay before you as it is. Thank you for this everyday, your healing touch in every cell, rebodying me, my presence to my deepest self. This, my everyday, I lay before you as it is.
It's lovely, the words of Mary Redmond Usher. And we're talking with Patrick, her son. Patrick, can we talk a little bit about the role faith played for your mother?
Faith was a hugely important part of my mother's life. She grew up in a traditional Catholic family, so she had that strong sense of faith from there. But I think her faith really transformed during her years of illness, because she was faced with a problem she couldn't solve, you know, when you're given this kind of diagnosis. And so one of the first things she was able to do was to surrender her fears, her concerns, her worries to God. And that was something she used to say. She used to say, over to you now, Lord. And another thing that really helped her with this, which was new for her, was also the practice of meditation. And in particular, the practice of Christian meditation, which was a practice of meditation developed by the Benedictine monk John Main, which involves sitting silently and repeating a mantra, Maranatha, which is the Aramaic word for come, Lord. And this, for my mother, was much more than, you know, a technique of being present or anything like that. It was actually sitting in a divine love for a period of time and resting in that. And she found that to be really healing and to give her a sense of receptivity to creation and the sense of preciousness of life that was all around her.
I'm wondering how your mother saw her a struggle or her experience of cancer. Did she look at it as a battle? Did she look at it as something that was happening to her?
I think it wasn't so much a battle, but it certainly was a cross to bear. It was something that was really hard. But it's also something that she knew many people had to deal with. So with a sense of compassion towards others as well, who walked the same path, living in that heart-filled space where you're able to sense also the suffering of others and realise that your suffering shares with theirs, that to find a path of light within that difficulty, that was the challenge. So it wasn't so much a battle. It was more about how can I an opportunity is too light a word as well. It's how can I find the sunbeam in this darkness?
3 years after her death, is this book part of your grieving process?
Yes, it is part of my grieving process. For me, I'd give anything for my mum to be back. But going through this book and having gone through all her diaries from those years, it makes me close to her spirit.
Mary McAleese launched the book for you recently, and she had some interesting words to say.
She did indeed. She picked out a certain passage from the book that my mum said, talking to God and taking from the Psalms, "You have turned my mourning into dancing." And for me, that's the essence of the Pink Ribbon Path. It's saying that there is this really hard reality, it's messy, but that there are these paradoxical blessings that can come. Mm. And that actually, those blessings are there for us, for all of us. Because in a way, we're all on a pink ribbon path, even if we haven't faced these kind of difficulties.
Signed up to it as yet. Patrick, you've mentioned that you were going through diaries, but I presume you also found other little bits and pieces that people leave behind them.
Yes, I did. And in fact, there was a scrap of paper amongst her belongings that we found in hospital. And presumably these are the last things that she wrote. And so it reads, "I am a graduate, summa cum laude, of the School of Suffering, aka the College of Cancer. I cry to you, summa cum laude, we are all in this together."
Who is the book for?
The book is for obviously those with breast cancer and their families and other serious illnesses. It's really for anyone facing incredible difficulty, however. It doesn't need to be confined to illness. It's for those moments when you're really struggling to find an answer. You can't solve it yourself. And you need a guide from someone who has walked that path before you.
What's the feeling that you have as you hold the book in your hand?
For me, it's deeply bittersweet. But I'm filled with huge pride, and I can imagine my mum smiling seeing it.
Patrick Usher, and the book is called Following the Pink Ribbon Path. Well, among our guests next week is biologist and fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who's in Dublin next Tuesday evening presenting a talk called Science and Spiritual Practices. And you can get more information on that talk at seminars.ie or on our webpage at rte.ie. That's The Leap of Faith for this week. From all of us here tonight, good night.